Hello and welcome to Overburden, the podcast for postal workers. I'm Brandy Hughes.
And I am Kevin Hitchings.
Today we're going to reflect on what was both of our first national conventions.
And I think we're starting season 5. For those of you that have been listening a while, our seasons kind of switch whenever we randomly take a break. And life's been very busy and really didn't want to take a break at this time, especially around convention. But that's the way life happened. So we ended up taking a break and now we're back.
Yeah, I think that part of the reason that we ended up kind of inadvertently taking a break is that we were trying to round up possible topics and guests. So hopefully that will come to fruition in the near future.
Yeah, and just time restraints were pretty crazy in the last month or two.
Right.
Partly because of convention.
Yeah, that's true.
610 delegates attended, 88 observers. Changed slightly day by day, but almost 700 people at convention.
I was actually really impressed when they gave the reports every morning to tell us how many delegates were in the room, and it was always like in the 605 to 609 range. So almost everyone was there.
Yeah, although we did have a couple COVID cases break out, so some people couldn't attend the whole convention, unfortunately.
Right.
But luckily, I haven't heard anything about it spreading into the masses or anything. So a few isolated cases, which is good, I hope. I hope nothing happened that I don't know about.
Yeah, I suppose there's the potential that 700 people caught COVID, right?
Yeah, well, I'm feeling fine, so everything's good there.
Same. Well, I mean, I'm sure everyone returned exhausted, but if you didn't get sick after having that extreme lack of sleep, then that probably means that you're okay.
So yeah, we're just going to talk about some of the things that were kind of the big topics, I guess, at convention. I think the main one is there was a lot of talk and a lot of rumor, I guess, the culture at National Office. There was one now former executive board member who talked about being bullied and harassed there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of mentions about how National Office was a little dysfunctional. I heard some NEB members say it was far worse than most people know, and some say it wasn't nearly as bad or there was some isolated conflicts. But it really kind of was in the background of everything that happened there. And nothing got nasty on the floor. Nobody called out anyone specifically. There was a talk about how one member, Dave Bleakney, was particularly picked on as medical information was supposedly discussed at the NEB openly. Some of the things that happened to him sound pretty bad, but I'm not sure if that was an isolated case or what. But other than that, nothing specific. But there was a lot of talk about that, about the culture at National Office.
Yeah, for those who are not informed, Brother Bleakney, for medical reasons, took a leave of absence in the last little while and was not at office towards the end of this term. Leaving Sister Simpson to step in and cover his duties as well, I believe.
Yeah, but I guess there's a lot of inappropriate discussion around his medical information.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, that's allegedly, what I'm saying. Allegedly. All we need to know is that Brother Bleakney needed time for medical reasons. That's all we need to know.
Yeah.
And that's all that should have been discussed at any office.
Yeah, and at any level.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I know Bran has some things to say about this, about how the union treats people that work for the union.
I have a lot to say about this.
I've heard brought up many times, 20 elected national and regional officers left in the last year. Heard a few different variations of this. Some said 20 in the last year, some said 30 in the last term. And sometimes those numbers got mixed back and forth. But I think we can reliably say at least 20 officers left, or recently at least.
Well, and that just goes to show that that people working at these offices, whether they be regional or national, are notoriously overworked. Like we expect so much out of the people at our local offices, and even the people who don't have office time, we expect them to volunteer a horrendous amount of time to help the members. And often there's no reward and people burn out because
there's an incredible amount of stress. And I don't think they count the union reps as officers, but they may be including that number as well. And the amount of time they put in is insane. And the Constitution actually is very restrictive. It says they don't get overtime, they don't get paid or credit for extra time worked. And it's actually in our constitution that no matter how much they work, they basically don't get bonus pay or bonus time off or anything like that. Which is kind of an insane thing for an organization whose purpose is to improve workers' rights to have in their constitution that their own workers don't get all these bonuses.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, we've negotiated and fought to have all of these breaks in our work time when we're working for the employer. But when the union is the employer, all of that goes out the window. And I think we see that at educationals and at conferences and at national convention, because your days are booked from like first thing in the morning until last thing at night. And maybe you might have one evening off, but then sometimes things get thrown into it. Yeah. I find it really funny that when we look at the policies in our national constitution, specifically looking at A29, and it talks about reducing the work week in order to create more full-time jobs and have more work-life balance. And it suggests working towards a 32-hour work week. But when you look at the scheduled agenda for national convention, it consists of nearly a 65-hour work week. So that's double what we're suggesting is a healthy amount of work for a person to do in a week.
Now, granted, it's a very expensive endeavor. And it's supposedly a one-off, like it's a one-off situation in theory, where you only have pre-convention, convention, and conference, depending on what year it is. So it's a rare thing that you're expected to do this. So,
sure.
But it sounds like for a lot of URs, especially, and directors, it's not a one-off thing. It's the norm. And that's one of the reasons why we're losing so many members. The Tuesday, I believe, was scheduled from 8 in the morning until I think it was 11 o'clock at night.
Yes.
So right there, you're looking at an insanely long day. And then almost every region had a caucus either before or after. The Prairie region, ours, had one both. So I believe that turned into about a 17 and a half hour day.
It was scheduled for 15 and then we added an hour at the beginning. So yeah, 16 plus, yeah.
Yeah, the early day.
I'm going to be honest, I can't remember how long that day was. I just know it was awful.
Yeah, it was extremely long. Another thing, I think in fairness, it was to try and combat this a little bit and keep the day shorter. But there's all kinds of caucuses. There's, as you call them, special interest groups, the LGBT, the equity seeking, Indigenous caucus. They all have their own little sessions. And most of the time, they were put on lunch breaks. So not only do you have a 15-hour day, but anyone who wants to take part in this session that's specifically for their group has to forfeit their lunch to do it. You know, it effectively makes an extremely long day with no real breaks, because usually there are only two breaks in a day, or one, your lunch break, your supper break, no coffee breaks. It just goes straight through the whole day. Yeah, it's a bit of a grind. And the groups that are supposed to require a special interest or have more need for their own focus have to give up something to get this. And that's been a complaint I've heard at many union events, actually, when they have breakouts like this. The only exception would be the men's, women's, and non-binary caucuses, because that would include pretty much everybody. So they were scheduled on their own time. But otherwise, all the groups were at lunchtime, so people had to give up their own to participate.
I had a definite feeling that a number of people felt that having gendered caucuses was kind of
dated,
redundant, and outdated, kind of backward thinking, because I know there are people who just said, you know what, I don't want to be put in a group and segregated based on my gender. Like, whatever my gender is, I don't feel it's any of your business, and I don't feel it has any bearing on my presence here at convention and what I'm contributing to the group. So why do I have to go to a special group?
And the ones I've been at, I haven't experienced this, but I've heard a lot of people say they don't go to the men's caucus anymore. And maybe this is an outdated thing that's changed, but the men's caucus, they say, is always just someone coming in and telling us how we suck because we're men and how we need to support the women better. I haven't had that experience, but I've heard a lot of guys say that men's caucus is just there to crap on men.
I also feel like we have to say something about the events of, we had it happen at our regional conference and then again at convention, where there was some disagreement as to whether trans women should be able to attend the Women's Caucus. And some of this was debated on the floor in both meetings, and definitely there were some people present who felt like their right to be there was questioned. And I for one believe that that's not right. I think that we all should be welcome to go to whichever group we want to go to. So I don't know. I feel like it's an ugliness that we've had to deal with, and I hate to see that it's continuing. I really was disappointed to see that it wasn't just at regional, but it was also at national, and that there was so much argument about it. You know, I just felt like that it was, personally, I feel like it's a no-brainer. It's just a thing that you accept that, okay, just people can be who they want to be, and great. You want to be this, be this, you know? So I don't know what to say about it. I don't know how to make it right, but it makes me sad.
Yeah, there was a little bit of heated discussion. There was a resolution put forward that women's committees should include anyone who basically identifies as a woman, and some people didn't like that. Although the debate, for the most part, people tried to be very respectful about it, about disagreeing with that position. Of course, it's a little heated sometimes when you're talking about sensitive issues like that. But for the most part, not so much at our regional one, but at national, it was a pretty respectful conversation. I thought as respectful as it could be. Not entirely, but...
Well, yeah, I don't know. There were, yeah.
I'm just saying, considering how it could have gone, it went
I suppose, fairly yeah, well. Considering how it could have gone, yeah, there's that. But, yeah, I don't know. To me, it goes back to safety and belonging, and not just physical safety, but psychological safety, to be accepted and to have support. And to, I think about it in the physical safety, and that, like, when women get together, they talk about, not to specifically focus on women's issues, but when women get together, we talk about all the little things that we do to be safe, and to navigate the world, and to support each other. And to me, someone who hasn't had that upbringing from birth even more benefits from that exposure to other women and the little things that they do, like just how to get home safe at night, or how to make sure that you don't end up in a bad situation, because the fact of the matter is women are more likely to be targets of violence.
Well, and a transgender person even more so.
Including trans
women, and yeah. I don't see how it would hurt to help somebody through that. They're not there to threaten, even if you don't agree with them being in that group for whatever reason, them being there isn't a threat to you. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you help another human being that needs help and needs assistance and needs to feel included? But that's just my opinion. So,
yeah. I mean, on top of that, there's other health related things that convention brought out. I mean, I look at the, like we talked about, the grueling schedule, and you look at how many people were saying, I haven't had enough sleep. I haven't had a chance to eat enough. I don't feel like I've had a vegetable today or whatever, because you're just eating whatever instant stuff you can get real quick in the short breaks.
Although the restaurants around the Harbor Castle Inn were actually pretty good. There was a good selection. It just took a little bit of effort, but eating out takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and sometimes you just want to cook your own stuff. But that's just part of traveling anywhere, I think.
Yeah, it is. One thing that was quite interesting was how long we spent talking about whether we could buy snacks for meetings.
Yeah, that was... We considering the convention is a week long, we didn't have a lot of time to do, I guess, the business of the union. There was a lot of guest speakers, a lot of interesting things, mm-hmm. A lot of talk, a lot of reports that had to be passed and moved. Right. But the main reason you go there is to elect new officers or re-elect officers and to make amendments and additions to the Constitution. Considering we had so little time to actually do that in that week-long schedule, I think it was like 6 hours or 8 hours total for amendments and additions to the Constitution. Something like that, spread over a day and a half.
Yep.
With breaks in between for other things, guest speakers, whatnot.
I did appreciate the breaks in between to have a guest speaker here and there, because I felt like too much of that would have been draining and people would have stopped paying attention.
But 2 hours of that was to say, 2 hours of that was to debate whether we could use rebate money to buy snacks for meetings, which was a little bit crazy. And a lot of people stood up, even from larger locals, and said, why are we debating this? We've always done that. You just, you know, put it under executive expenses or whatever. I'm not sure what they put
committee
it under.
Committee expenses is not
committee really expenses.
A valid one, but we've never
Technically you shouldn't, because a general meeting is not a committee. A lot of people have been doing it for a long time. And just 2 hours at a convention was a little insane, I thought.
Well, there were a number of complaints at convention this time that, and I don't know if this is normal, because like I said, this was our first time, that the resolutions that were brought forward to be voted on were kind of inconsequential. They were housekeeping ones.
A lot of them. And you need to do the consequential, you need to do the housekeeping ones, and they try to sneak them between breaks when you only have 10 minutes left or something.
Right.
But it seemed like the vast majority of them were housekeeping. We didn't do a lot of real heavy, substantial stuff, which made some people say, I've heard a couple of people say the convention was a total waste because of that. I don't completely agree with that. But there were a lot of people super frustrated with the lack of meat to the resolutions that made it. The main thing, and there was some good ones, like we talked about adding URs to the region. Expanding Turtle Island courses, having a regular National Women's Committee meeting with representatives from every region, and a youth meeting, caucuses, increasing strike pay came up.
Oh, yes. I love that one. The changes that were made there so that you don't have to put in the 5 days. It's like, if we do rotating strikes and you strike one day, you still get a portion of your pay.
Which is huge. Some cities went on strike multiple days. I think Edmonton went off a few. Toronto went off a few. Saskatoon only went off one last time.
Yeah.
And some cities didn't go off at all. But, you know, let's say a city goes off 4 days. Well, you don't get strike pay until it's five. And I think it says five consecutive even. I'm not sure.
I think it has to be five in a work week, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's kind of unfair when somebody loses 3, 4, 5 days and gets no pay, whereas other people work straight through and get paid all the way. So yeah, they changed it so you get paid daily if you go on strike. Mm-hmm. And the union does that to disrupt the employer. They don't do that to, you know, get out of strike pay.
Right.
But
I think this will help though, because that was one of the complaints last strike, that we were rotating strikes and then it basically meant that no one got any strike pay.
Right. So there's a few numbers and guesstimates thrown around. They figure with the added URs and these extra committees and courses that we put in, that it was going to cost the union about $7 million. And that's without the strike pay, because no one can predict strike pay, $7 million a year. The most frustrating thing to me and to a lot of other people is National put out a discussion paper a few months ago for mm-hmm. convention, saying our main issue was dues reforms.
They had five big issues.
Well, five, but the main one was dues reforms. Mm-hmm. And then they had a conference call with all the regions to talk about how we might restructure dues, and among other things, but dues again was the main thing.
Yeah.
And every region, from what I hear, put forward and passed something on dues reforms. The main two issues are, one, our revenue is not as high as it should be. We need to bring in a little bit more money. And secondly, we all know that the new employees who barely work pay full dues, so they get very small or even negative paychecks on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just way too much of a hardship on new people. So we were talking about a percent-based system where you always just pay a percent of your dues rather than just a flat rate. That way, if you don't work very much, you don't pay very much. So the full-time people that have been there a long time might pay a little bit more. Your dues might go up a bit, mm-hmm. but the new people would go down and it would even out. And overall, depending on the percentage, your dues or the overall dues or the revenue for the union would go up a little bit, and that would help our finances.
Right.
What was super frustrating is every region, when I told, like I say, passed one of these and put it forward to national convention.
And some of them were more complicated formulas than others. Some of them were just flat percentages, and some of them were a little bit more intricate.
So if you're unaware, what happens is we go to regional conventions, we debate all the resolutions that came up from the locals or the the regional office. And then we decide which ones they want to put forward to national. And then when they get to national, there's a national resolutions committee, two people from each region, who decide which version of which one they want to put forward, mm-hmm. or which ones go together. And they're supposed to do it on, you know, whatever seems most important to the regions. Like if a region passed something with 100% unanimous, it's going to be strong. And if all eight regions put forward similar resolutions, well, that has to be very high on the list, because obviously everybody wants this. And basically they said, well, it was complicated with the dues, so we just left them out. And we did a ton of, like we say, these housekeeping ones, and didn't touch dues at all. It wasn't on the agenda.
And people kept bringing it up and saying, why are we not talking about dues? And actually getting up to the microphone and saying, can we add it to the agenda? Like, we want to talk about this. We want to vote on it. Let's pass something about dues reform.
And that's where these numbers came up. People come and say, hey, this new women's committee meetings that we added are going to cost about this much. And these youth committee meetings that we added are going to cost about this much. And every time they say, hey, this is $3 million. Hey, this is $5 million. Now we're at a $7 million plus the strike pay. Where are the dues? And they're basically said, well, we thought that was complicated. We thought we'd get through quantity rather than quality. But how do you pay for this quantity? And, yeah. You know, there was a lot of effort put forward to making sure we fix this issue. And this has been something that we've talked about for as long as I've been around, even to the point where mm-hmm. we have to reduce the number of regions to save money. So I thought National put a lot of work into fixing this and a lot of momentum just to, you know, not tell us what to do, but just let us know how important it was and give us options. And then it was just neglected by the resolutions committee.
Well, that was the thing with the discussion paper, is that, you know, it was sent out nationally so that everyone could get thinking about these ideas, these greater problems that our union has been facing in the last number of years, and try to come up with solutions and then send them in and have them either, you know, take pick up from amongst them or make combinations of the suggestions to make something that works for the whole country. And yeah. then to have all of that effort be wasted, it feels so frustrating and fruitless, and makes you question why you bothered to write resolutions.
The National Policies Committee, we've talked about the policies a couple times before. There's the white pages in the Constitution that are kind of the rules, and then the policies, which are our ideas and principles we want to promote. So there's two separate committees. That the National Policy Committee was also kind of a mess, to be honest. We talked about A26 a lot.
Oh, yes, the remote work.
Yeah, and they were talking about saying it's important because union workers need to be allowed to work from home and give flexibility. But that's not what the policy is about in any way. And the committee is supposed to understand and analyze these pages and put forward a resolution. And they give motivation. They say, this is the change we want, and this is why. And all their whys had nothing to do with what the policy is actually about. So it's like, how are you putting things forward that you don't understand? Because A26 is about basically stopping employers from forcing people to work from home. Has nothing to do with the union, has nothing to do with how we govern ourselves. There's no rule against us working from home if that's what the region or the national decides is appropriate.
And it was discussed at length how for a great portion of the COVID period, National Office essentially was working remotely and coming to the office as little as possible.
Yeah, so that probably took a half hour at a convention where we were just people were trying to understand what exactly are we even voting on, because people are arguing about this, and that one took forever. And the committee couldn't even explain what we were voting on. Basically said, I don't know, after they gave motivation and reasoning for putting this one forward. It made no sense.
I feel like that was a difficult conversation, because up until we hit the pandemic, everyone could say, yeah, remote work's bad. I can see how it can be abused, and there'll be no line between work and home life. And, you know, the employer will just use you 24/7, right? But I think a bunch of people did experience working mm-hmm. from home in the last 3 years, and some people found it to be bad, but some people found it to be good. They found it to be easier to balance life, and some people found it hard to create lines and boundaries between them.
Well, there's lots of reasons we shouldn't let the employer force somebody, or arguably even allow somebody to work from home, because of the way they can abuse that and abuse the person. Mm-hmm. But the resolution is specific about employers, mm-hmm. and everybody's arguing about why isn't the union allowed to do this, and the motivation was about the union. They're totally different things. And people got up, like, we stopped the vote about three times for people to ask for a clarification. Like, what exactly are we even talking about? Good work done in that session too. And I don't want to focus on all the frustrations. Again, going back to the resolutions more than the policies for sure. Like I say, we did add some URs and strengthen turtle island and things like that. So stuff, there was a lot about just rebuilding capacity and making sure that young people were coming up in the system. One of the most disappointing, or I guess I would say, or weird things I found is I think there's 12 or 13, I think it's 13 national officers when you include the URs. So you got the president, secretary, treasurer, grievance officer, all the vice presidents, and then the URs. We have 47,000 members, roughly. And then you have the, in theory, at least 800 of the most engaged, active people at this convention. And of those executive members, the 12 or 13, whatever it was, only two positions were actually contested. Everyone else was just acclaimed. And it's like, that shows, I think, a real disengagement. And I know it's difficult because people have to move to Ottawa, essentially. Although, again, you don't technically have to, but in practice, and the way the rule, the way it's been done, is that you have to move to Ottawa. So that's hard. But still, to have, you know, so many people, even the first vice president, just acclaimed, and not that many people wanting to do those jobs, it's just kind of sad.
I know. I found that really sad that we didn't. There should have been at least three people trying for each of those positions. Like, if there's that many of us nationwide, then why are any of these positions being acclaimed? Like, what is wrong with those jobs? And I think we're speaking about either toxic environment or overwork and lack of work-life balance. And like you say, the number of people who just cannot uproot their lives and their families and move to Ottawa or wherever their regional headquarters is. And that's why A26 kept coming up, is that people kept interpreting it to mean that it was about working for the union and whether you could do that remotely. Because all of a sudden, if you could do those jobs remotely, a whole lot more people would be like, you know what, I could be whatever. No. But most of us can't. I mean, I can't. You can't. I don't know a lot of people who can.
No, but there's a lot of people who live in that region even. Sure. That could. And it's just odd that only two positions were contested. So that was something that really stood out. And even when we got into our regional caucus and you added those people in, there I know there was 23 when you added them together. There's only one person running for UR that didn't get in. So of our five URs, there was only six. And then regional director was the only other one contested. And everyone else just got acclaimed. So not a lot of engagement there. Mm-hmm. And our regional offices in Winnipeg, that's a pretty large local with a large number of people who wouldn't have to move. So just strange again. I don't know what that says about the state of our union. I could just say that everyone's super happy with our leadership, although quite a few of the executive members did change at the national level. I don't know. Maybe.
I think it says that we're not really interested in representation from all of the areas. Like, we're willing to sacrifice. We're willing to sacrifice representation for convenience.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a weakness of the National Constitution Committee or a weakness of leadership that when they put that much effort into promoting something like dues reforms, that it never even comes up, that no one, like, is this, they didn't take direction, or they just, I don't know, just it's strange that things didn't go the way people expected to go, because that was a lot of the talk, is how are we going to do this? When it comes up, how are we going to do the reforms? What are you going to vote for? How do you want them to see? What should the percentage be? And then to see it never even hit the floor.
I think that's why that one resolution was so important to so many people about letting each region pick a resolution to put top of the list.
Yeah, there was talk about that too.
This is our most important thing and we want to talk about it at National Convention.
Yeah, we do that at our regional. Every local is allowed to put one forward that is guaranteed to make the floor just by default without discussion, essentially. Not without discussion, but it gets through. There was some good things on the committee. or on the convention, though, I know we're talking about a lot of the negatives. Again, we did get a lot of good work done, and it was a lot of work. I didn't see what Brian was saying, how they read out the number of delegates that were actually there every day. So even with that grueling schedule, people stuck with it, you know. By the end, I was expecting to see actually a lot of empty chairs.
No, we were missing like maybe five people every day when they did roll call.
But yeah.
It was impressive.
Yeah, and even the sessions that were no votes and things happening, guest speakers, stuff like that, you expect to see a few people after a week that long just sneak out for an extra break or something. There was very little of that. There wasn't a lot of traffic outside in the lobby even.
Yeah.
It was really good.
I think that a lot of the people standing outside in the lobby, and I know I was guilty of this too, you're getting up and you're leaving the room just to get up and move around. It's not that you're not paying attention, and I love that they had the discussion going on the screens outside.
Yeah.
So you could see it from the larger room, and just to be able to stand up and walk around a little bit, because sitting in a chair all week is torture for letter carriers and a bunch of other people who are used to working, whether in the plant or outside. You're just used to going and moving and working all the time. And so sitting in a chair just, at first it seems like a nice break, but after day three, you're like, no, I need to do something. I need to get out.
Well, one of the good things too is they have these translation devices, so you can, they're basically headphones. And when someone's speaking in French, there's an English channel, a translator speaks in your ear in English and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So you could actually walk into the back area with your headphones on and not miss a thing. I got up surprisingly little. Usually I can't sit for even half a day, but I sat through the majority of that convention without issue. So when I did get up, those translation devices were just great for listening in.
Mm-hmm.
I usually stand in the back anyway. I didn't leave too often. There was a lot of commitment and a lot of talk about fighting the employer hard next round. The Building Power to Win campaign came up a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And how we're not as mobilized as we would like to be, but we're still rebuilding and restructuring, but there is a lot more will to fight. And the National Executive Board, a lot of them got up and said, we are not taking crap this round. There's going to be full negotiations, no deal taking about this 2% thing, which came up a lot. Well, last time we had that 2% extension, they did explain why they did that, why they thought it was a good idea.
Because
why
they thought it was worth it to get postal banking.
Yeah, mostly, not entirely, but mostly because of postal banking.
Which ended up not working out anyway because of the way it was handled by TD.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty surprised by that. I never liked having TD as a partner.
No.
But I understand why they wanted them. I did not know that TD could essentially pull the plug at any time they wanted. And it appears that TD mostly pulled the plug because things were going so well. They didn't expect it to go that well. They didn't want the competition, so they yanked it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's highly unfortunate. But one of the main focuses in the next round is going to be, we're doing full banking services, not limited, like just these loans that TD wanted, be full banking services or a lot closer to full. And we're doing it alone. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that pans out. I know that's a big ask because it requires government intervention and stuff too, but that'll be one of the main focuses. And there's a lot of talk about not backing down and fighting back quite a bit, and that came from pretty much everybody on the NEB and anybody who was running for election as well. So I think we're seeing an attitude shift where they're just tired of arguing over which concession we have to make to get which gain, and it's just forget it. It's time to just get gains. So we'll see how that carries out when and if negotiations break down, because, you know, who knows, they could go swimmingly in next round and have wonderful talks with the employer.
Yeah, first time ever.
Yeah.
I did find it interesting that a number of, particularly the smaller locals, seem to be saying that they hadn't really had a chance to get into the building worker power stuff, but it did seem like the ones that had started it were generally kind of more fired up. The people were a little bit more aggressive in their attitudes toward the employer, and maybe even their attitudes toward each other, but as long as things work out in the end, that's all good, right? It's good to have people who are passionate about things. And I really hope that that campaign does continue. I know we're running another course in it next month in our local. But with the change of third vice president, I'm hoping that that campaign doesn't die, because it does seem like a lot of people are buying in. And just the changes I've seen in our local, like especially the newer members who weren't really engaged with the union before, who took that class, and all of a sudden they want to go to the educationals, they want to join committees, they want to participate. And I think that's a great thing. We always talk about building secondary leadership, and I'm seeing a lot more younger people who are kind of just easing their way in now that they've kind of had that flame lit.
Yeah. So should probably just go over real quick the new National Executive Committee. I'll leave president for last, I think. First vice president, Kaiser Maruf, and Rona Eckert, who was the UR for consultation previous, were running for first vice president. Maruf decided to let Rona have it, so she was acclaimed, as he ran for third vice president instead, vacated by Roland Schmidt, who decided to not reoffer. Bev Collins is the National Secretary Treasurer, again acclaimed. She's great, though. She does everything.
Pronounce it Gerard?
Yeah, I think his last name is Gerard. Gerard. Is the National Grievance Officer, again acclaimed. He was in there before. Colleen Jones was acclaimed a second VP. She's new to the board. And then, like I said, Kaiser Maruf decided to run for third against Judy Hutton, who I'm not sure where she came from. They said came from another union, but she did a lot of organizing there. And she ended up winning in that position. And then Martin Champagne, who's been around, I think this is third term in that position, might only be a second. But he was acclaimed back again to fourth VP. For president, we had Jan Simpson, our previous president, running against Julie Sanderson, who was our first VP last term. Jan ended up winning that 392 to 204, so almost 2-1, 65.8% decided to vote for Jan.
That was kind of the big exciting one at the beginning. I think there was a lot of campaigning on that. I don't know. It was just very, I felt like it was intense.
I didn't see a lot of campaigning from Jan. I saw Julie's campaign was much more organized and much more in your face.
I wonder if that's just because Jan was focusing her efforts in Eastern Canada rather than in the Prairie region.
Well, I just mean at convention and all at all. He saw signs for Julie. Even the stuff that came out, the websites and the mailings and the videos, there was a lot more for Julie than Jan.
Well, and she had people standing at the doorways handing out pamphlets.
Julie did, yes. But Jan, again, was also doing a lot of Dave Bleakney's job, plus Oregon, because he was away on medical, and her own job, and you know, doing a lot with conventions. So she may have just had less time. Maybe. I think a lot of people saw a lot of weakness in her, because people weren't, not really weakness in her, I guess, weakness in her position. A lot of people weren't happy with this 2% extension we took. The mandatory vaccine, they thought we should have fought a lot harder against that, some people. And just things slowed down in national office in general with COVID, because that took so much focus off. Jan was in a pretty tough position.
And like we said before, they weren't actually working from the office for great periods of it. So it's kind of reasonable to assume that less work would get done. I also feel that, I mean, and this is my position in the greater union, is that these are committees. They're not one person. There's not a dictator. It's a committee of all the people on that committee. And so you can't, that one person doesn't have all the power, and you can't give them all the blame or all the credit. It should be shared amongst the group.
Yeah, just a lot of people, I think, saw weakness in her position because she did take blame for that. And I think she really countered a lot of the narrative, at least in the Prairie region. What I've heard about her a lot is she's a good, strong unionist, but she's not good with the media. She doesn't speak very well. She doesn't present herself very well. And honestly, I've only seen her speak once in person. She seemed kind of shy and nervous in reading her notes and didn't do amazing that time. And I think that's the opinion a lot of people had of her.
There are definitely more commanding speakers in our union, yes.
But she completely countered that narrative running convention. She was mm-hmm. confident, amusing, loud, on point. It's pretty much impossible to control the floor at all moments, but she did a really good job in general of controlling the floor, even when things got unruly.
With 600 delegates and a bunch of observers.
Yeah, it's impossible to do it perfectly, but I thought she did pretty good well. And she really did command the floor, and she spoke well and articulately. And I don't know French very well, but she sounded really good and confident in French as well.
All we got was the English translation of what she said.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people expected her to kind of fumble through a little bit and, you know, not be very confident, but she put in a really good showing that I think countered what a lot of people thought of her.
Maybe that's why she won.
I think that's one of the reasons she won. We talked a little bit earlier about the possible work environment at National, and Julie did get called out for behavior on the floor a couple times, and nothing with National specifically, but I think a lot of people, fair or not, kind of assumed the two went together, and I think she took out some blame for that, and that really hurt her. And then maybe there was a flyer she put out the last day or the second last day that a lot of people kind of took as an attack ad that I read it. It wasn't the best ad in the world. It wasn't as harsh as some people assumed. I think a lot of people didn't read it. But there was a lot of talk about how it was. There was a lot of talk, and it just wasn't received well, I think, in general. And I think that hurt her as well. So those are the main things. Just generally, by the amount of applause and the people standing up to applaud on the floor, it looks like Jan probably had Quebec, Montreal, Toronto, and I think maybe the Atlantic region as well. But and that's a lot to overcome.
Well, they have so many more delegates from, you know, the general Ontario, Quebec area that it's like voting in national elections. Like in the general populace, you feel like your votes don't count because it's whatever they decide over there. Never going to be running for national president, so it's not really something I'm worrying about.
Like I said, I did have a discussion or two with some people on the NEB, and I didn't hear Julie's name come up at all with any of the bullying or with any of the problems at National, but I think a lot of people just made that assumption just from the general talk on the floor and the fact that she did get called out. She did get called out twice in the mic, fairly or not. And who knows? Like, it may not have mattered anyway. Like, the gap between Simpson and Sanderson was quite wide. We're looking at almost 200 votes with only 600 voting members.
I still think, you know, 200 votes is nothing to sneeze at, right? I mean, it's a showing.
But there's definitely some regions that vote as blocks.
Oh, yes, for sure.
And seem to be firmly behind Jan.
I would have liked to have them say hit 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, though, if we'd had more people running for each position.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I was going to say, only the two positions on the National Executive Committee of the 7 were contested. But we should say that both those contested positions were only the two people.
Right. There was never a fourth option. It was this person, that person, or spoil your ballot. There was never a third person to vote for or a fourth person to vote for. And I feel like that's sad. I feel like it says that there's a problem. And I think it is the same problem we've been talking about for a long time. It's the engagement. And the engagement is challenged from the work floor up. Like, this is why building worker power is kind of feeling like a bit of a storm going across the country, is that it's helping with that somewhat, but I don't know if that's going to be long-term help. I don't know if we're going to see more people getting involved and stepping into positions and willing to make the sacrifices that apparently you have to make in order to do those jobs. So yeah, it's an ongoing problem. And I think that when you look at those elections, it just very clearly demonstrates that there are so many people who are just not willing to get involved, and they're not willing to lose time with their families. They're not willing to move. They're not willing to lose pay over it.
Yeah. The National Secretary Treasurer The grievance officer and the president are the same. So we have a mostly new board. Hmm. Also, it's pointed out that most of the board is female, which I'm surprised is the first time this has happened. Because we have...
I did notice that as the elections were going on.
Yeah, we have Jan Simpson, Ronna Eckert, Bev Collins, Colleen Jones, and Judy Hutton. And then for men on the committee, we have Carl Girard. I always get his last name wrong. Sorry if you're listening, Carl, by any chance. And Martin Champagne are the only two men on the executive committee right now.
Weren't some of the URs?
Yeah, but the executive committee is just these seven. The board includes the national directors. National. And unfortunately, I don't know who all the national directors are because we split into caucuses. I know ours stayed is Lana Schmidt, who was the incumbent, but I'm not sure what happened in all the other regions.
Betcha we could look it up.
We could if we really wanted to, but this has gone on pretty long and I'm pretty lazy.
Okay, maybe I'll look it up and put it on our Facebook page.
Alrighty. And you can do that while you're waiting for our next episode, which if we don't get off track again, will hopefully be in 2 weeks.
So if you want to be on the show, or you have any ideas for topics, or you just want to tell us what you think.
Questions, comments, or concerns?
Yeah, you can email us at overburdenpod@gmail.com.
And we'll talk to you then. Have a good night.